Welcome to this audio sermon presented by Blue Letter Bible. Due to the fragile nature of cassette tape storage, a portion from the end of this teaching became inaudible. Fortunately, we do not believe any of the spiritual content or the applications contained within the rest of this message have been affected. We thank you for listening, and may the Lord richly bless the time you spend in His Word.
I don't know about you, but you know, sometimes to me, life can seem like a tangled maze of ups and downs, sort of a mixed bag of positives and negatives, of joys and sorrows, of sunshine and rain, of relational intimacy or relational conflict, you know, tastes of success and then the pain of defeat. And then there's times when you'll get flashes of insight, and then other times when you kind of feel intellectually and spiritually dull, sort of lost in a bog or a swamp. And it's times like these that, or seasons like these that we go through, that we can kind of feel mentally and emotionally adrift, sort of lost in the fog and tempted to proclaim, like the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes, "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And you kind of feel like everything is going nowhere, and you get weary, and you get tired. And you know, it's times like that that we need perspective more than we need specific answers. And we need hope more than we need detailed explanations or methodologies. And I think it's helpful for us to realize that our personal histories, our own individual pilgrimages, are not a whole lot different than the corporate or total history of God's people leading up to the time of Christ. Ephesians 3 tells us that God was sovereignly at work through the ages, through all the mishmash of historical events, carrying out His specific and sovereign plan. And yet, He was doing this through sort of a confused set of events. At least it was confusing in terms of God's people and even the intellectually superior angels. They looked down and they tried to figure out, what is God up to? What is He doing? And the whole program really didn't come to light until Jesus Christ came on the scene and the church was created. And so now the angels of heaven look down and they see the church. And we look back from the perspective of the New Testament, and it all fits together. And we've been tracing that as we've been going through this series. We began with Adam and the fall of man, and from there we went on to the characters of Noah and Abraham and Sarah and Joseph and Moses, as Skip would have me say, and Joshua and David and Daniel and Elijah and Ruth. And now we come to Esther. And the value of the story of Esther is a principle that it provides for us. A principle which, like the story of Joseph and like the whole history of God's people and leading up to Christ, a principle that gives a perspective of hope in the midst of all the details and confusing mass that we find ourselves in the day to day. Something that will help us sort out what's going on. Help us to see our lives from God's vantage point. And that vantage point is the hilltop of God's sovereign control, as Mark was pointing out just a few seconds ago. Somehow we begin to gain perspective when we realize that God is in control of every single thing that happens in our individual lives and throughout history. Somehow we can keep from despairing, we can maintain hope, when we realize, as the book of Esther is going to show us, that God sovereignly controls everything that happens for the good of His people and for the accomplishment of His purposes. That's what the book of Esther is going to tell us this morning. Basically, it's Romans 8:28, that God is working everything together for the good of His people and His plans. And we even see this major principle of the book previewed in the very first section of the story of Esther. So let's turn there. If you haven't already turned to Esther, open to the middle of your Bibles, which is Psalms, and go left, two books, okay? And you'll find it. Right before Job. And we'll begin here with chapter 1, verse 1. Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, boy, there's a lot of qualifiers here, right? Here's the point. He gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles, and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. And when these days were completed, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Susa, the capital, from the greatest to the least in the court of the garden of the king's palace. And as we go on there, we find out that while he was throwing his big bash out in the court of the palace there, his queen, Vashti, was allowed a corner of the palace to throw a little party for all the gals. I kind of showed you where things were at in those days. But now, to kind of get this into historical context of what we call secular history, Ahasuerus is none other than Xerxes, the famous emperor of the Medo-Persian Empire, the one that conquered the Babylonian Empire. And this meeting, this banquet that he has called together is not just to have a good time. He's called all of his rulers together for a conference to plot and to plan the takeover of Greece. And if you remember your ancient history, they failed at that. They beat the Spartans up there a little bit in a certain pass, I forget the name of it, but Xerxes was defeated in the Sea Battle of Salamis. But before this happens, right here, they're plotting and planning that very war. Now, Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's called here in our Bible, goes on and gets a little drunk. And in his drunkenness, he decides, hey, I've got a great idea. Vashti's a beautiful woman. I'm going to have her come in here to my party and display her beauty and entertain everybody. And Vashti says, forget it. There's no way that I'm going to be exploited like that. And so the king gets mad, and he calls all of his attendants and advisors together. He says, what are we going to do about this? And his advisors fear the first women's lib movement and say that if we let Vashti get away with this, then all the women in the kingdom are going to disrespect their husbands and not going to listen to a thing they say. So we've got to deal very harshly with Vashti. And so through the rest of chapter 1, we find out that they go through with this plan, and Vashti is cast away into oblivion. I'll explain what that is in a second. And then after that, that's when King Xerxes goes off with his armies, and they lose to the Greeks. Now he comes back. And in chapter 2, having just been defeated by the Greeks, he's starting to think about other things, and he remembers Vashti. Now, pick it up in first part of chapter 2 there. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants who served him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to Susa, the capital, to the harem, into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in the place of Vashti. And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Then it says, now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai. Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now the who in verse 6 is talking about Kish, not Mordecai. Okay? Otherwise, we've got real historical problems. Who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, from Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and exiled. If this was Mordecai that we were talking about, this guy is really old because they were taken into exile, like over 100 years before this. So we're talking about his relative here. And he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther. I think Hadassah means myrtle. I don't know what the significance of that is. And Esther is the Persian word which means star. So Esther's a star here. For she had neither father nor mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, key element of the story here. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. And so it goes on to say that the decree went out and many young ladies were gathered to the capital city. And of course, Esther, being beautiful of form and face, was lumped in there with them. And Esther found a special favor with the eunuch who was in charge of the women, Haggai, and he gave her sort of some special privileges there in terms of getting prepared by the cosmetics and all that. There was a little process that they were going through here, sort of a two-house harem system. For a year, they'd be in the first house under Haggai, and they would go through all these different cosmetic treatments and, you know, get beautified to the max. And maybe there was even a health spa there, I don't know. And then after that year, each woman would have her chance to come before King Xerxes and for one night. And then after that, she would be taken to another house of the harem. And there she would stay and live and rot, maybe, unless King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, decided that he kind of liked her and wanted her to come back. So it's kind of like, you know, a one-shot chance here, and that's it. And we might assume from this that the oblivion that Vashti was thrown out into was the second house. She was put aside into that second collection place or house of the concubines, and there she stayed and was never called on again, at least until many years later, as we find out from secular history. But then it comes time or turn for Esther to go before King Ahasuerus. And in verse 15 it says, "Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what..." I turned two pages instead of one. Hang on a second. When you buy a Bible, get one with thick pages. It will help you out. Okay. Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised her to take some certain things, and that's what she took. And it says, "And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty." So there it is. Esther makes the top. For some reason, King Xerxes liked Esther more than all the other beautiful virgins of the whole empire of Medo-Persia. And then we find out as we go on to read that Mordecai is sitting near the city gate and he uncovers a plot to assassinate Xerxes, and the guys get nailed, and Mordecai is a hero. But he doesn't receive any reward or any recognition for that heroism until much later. But that's sort of a little tag, and it's thrown into the story because its significance will come out later. But the main point of this first section is that Esther becomes queen. And we see the principle that we were talking about earlier at work here. I mean, such things as the fact that Xerxes wanted to go to war against Greece and had this big party was under the control of God. And that the fact that he got drunk and decided to have his wife come and display her beauty, the folly of all that was under the sovereign control of God, leading up to the protection of his people. And Vashti's refusal, under the sovereignty of God. His defeat with the Greeks and coming back and looking for something new to fill out his life. That was under the sovereignty of God. And the beauty of form and face that we find in Esther, certainly the sovereignty of God. And then finally, even the whim of the king, his preference in women, if you will, under the sovereignty of God. And even Esther's breaking of the Mosaic law by marrying a Gentile under the sovereignty of God. And God has put Esther in the position of queen, and he's going to use that to deliver his people and to preserve them and to preserve his plans. Because you see, if the Jews are wiped out, which is the danger that occurs in this book, Jesus Christ would never come. And so God has got to protect his people to preserve his programs. You know, this whole story of Esther and also our own lives, I think at times can seem kind of like a Rube Goldberg machine. How many here are familiar with Rube Goldberg? He's that guy that designed those strange and complicated machines to accomplish what seemed like the most simple tasks. So while I was at the library the other day, I tried to get an exciting example here for you, one that you could all relate to, a garage door opener. Now keep in mind that this is not an electric garage door opener. This is, and it's not even the kind of garage that goes up like this. This is a sliding garage door. Okay, you have to know that or this machine doesn't make any sense. And this is Professor Butt's automatic garage door opener, 1928. See how ahead of his times he was here. Okay, here's how it works. You drive auto bumper A against mallet B, pushing it down and exploding cap C. Frightening rabbit D, who runs toward his burrow E. Pulling string F, which discharges pistol G. The bullet penetrates can H, from which the water drips into aquarium I. As the tide rises in the aquarium, it elevates the floating cork upright, J, which pushes up the end of seesaw K, causing flea L to lose its balance and fall on the gedunk sleeping hound's tail, M, who wakes up and chases his tail round and round, causing platform N to spin and turn on faucet O. Water runs through hose P, starting revolving lawn sprinkler Q, on which rope R winds itself, opening the garage door. Then he adds, of course, if you wish, you can drive right through the door, and then there won't be an obstruction left to bother you in the future. I think as we look at the story of Esther and all the little ins and outs that God is going to use to accomplish his purposes, and even as we look at our own lives, they oftentimes seem like Rube Goldberg's. Complicated and strange, but they get the job done. And the job that God is trying to get done in our lives is what? To make us like Jesus Christ. And somehow he is using all the crazy things that happen in our lives, ups and the downs, all the confusion, the periods of disillusionment, all of that, he is using to move us along toward the goal of making us like Christ. And that's the perspective that we need today, the one that we need this morning. Now, besides this main principle that fits with the story of Esther, there's some sub-principles that we're going to find as we continue on through the story, which sort of help to fill out that main principle and explain some of its implications. So let's continue with the story now in chapters 3 and 4. Now remember, Esther is queen, and Mordecai has uncovered a plot against Xerxes and basically saved his life. All of these things are going to come into play later. But now, to make any good story, you have to have conflict. So here's the conflict. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 3 here. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command?" Now it was when they had spoken daily to him, and he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Remember, of course, Jews are not going to bow down to anybody but Yahweh. And Mordecai here is a faithful Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. All the Jews in the Medo-Persian Empire, which were basically ruled the world at that time, which would mean all the Jews, and would mean the end of God's plan leading up to Jesus Christ. So we've got a serious problem right here. Now, it says that Haman goes on and he casts lots, or casts the pur, which we find out later is significant because there's a holiday called Purim, which shows up at the end of this book. But he was casting lots to figure which day he wanted to destroy the Jews on. Then he goes to King Xerxes, and he proposes this plan. Look at verse 8 here. He says, "Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, 'There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom.'" Get this. "Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws, so it is not in the king's interest to let them remain." Kind of sounds like what Jesus said. The world will hate you because you believe and love and follow me. But at any rate, Haman goes on and he devises this plan that on a certain day, all the people throughout the kingdom, all the enemies of the Jews, are to have open season on them and have the permission of the king to destroy them all. And they send out this edict through all the land of Medo-Persia Empire. So Mordecai learns of the plot, and he mourns along with many other Jews there. Somehow Esther doesn't know about it, but she hears that Mordecai is in anguish and wants to know why, and so Mordecai lets her know through Esther's servant, one of the eunuchs, and basically tells her, "Okay, honey, it's up to you. You've got to get us out of this thing. You've got to go to the king and stop this plot against us." And then we find Esther's reply, sort of the give and take that goes on here between Esther and Mordecai. And Hattach, that's the eunuch, came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. "Esther, you got to get us out of this." Then Esther spoke to Hattach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. "All the king's servants," this, by the way, is, did I tell you, we're at verse 11 right now of chapter 4. "All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days." Xerxes hadn't seen her for a month. And they related Esther's words to Mordecai. Now this is the crux of this section of the book right here. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews." And then this is the verse. "For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this." And so then Esther says, okay, she'll go along with it, but she wants 3 days of fasting before she approaches the king. Fasting was a custom in those days, and it was meant to humble yourself before God and kind of humble yourself so much that he wouldn't want to humble you anymore and instead would exalt you. That was kind of the psychology behind fasting. So they're fasting. But the point here, I think, again, is verse 14. "If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish." The sub-principle here is that nothing can stop God's plans, not even us if we refuse to cooperate. in sort of an applicational sense, God doesn't need our service, but he can use it. It's sort of like the old parable of the cowardly nail. I'm sure you haven't heard this parable. I just made it up a few days ago. Once upon a time, there was a man who wanted to hang a picture on a wall. And he had a box of nails, but he only had one picture to hang. So he reached into the box of nails, pulled out a nail, and was about ready to put it into the wall. When all of a sudden, the nail said, wait, don't use me. If you pound me into the wall, I might get bent. And so the picture hanger said, okay, forget you. And he threw the nail away and grabbed another. He says, but this picture is going on the wall. Now, you may think that illustration is a little bit off the wall. But you get the point. I thought of you when I designed that. Sometimes we get the idea that we are absolutely essential to the success of God's plans. That somehow if we don't contribute our vast sums of money or exercise our tremendous talents of teaching and wisdom and leadership ability, that God's jobs and programs aren't going to get accomplished. But the plain fact of the matter is that God doesn't need a single one of us. We need him. It's in our interest to be of service to him. Because if we're not useful, that's okay. He'll get another nail. And if you don't put forth your money for the ministry of God's service, that's okay. God will provide for it from somewhere else. And if you don't declare the truth, and if you don't provide leadership, that's okay. God's got other people. And so we need to look at service as an opportunity, as a privilege, as something that is a benefit to us. And we should especially want to be used by God in a positive way because, you know, every single person, as this story has shown us, is being used by God. And you can either be used in spite of yourself as a negative factor, or you can be used positively and willingly in the service of God and his plans. And of course, we all know that that is where life is. That is where real fulfillment is. And so when we give and when we serve or whatever we do, let's keep in mind that it's a privilege. And not that God needs us, but that we need him. We need, for our own fulfillment and enjoyment, the opportunity to be useful to him. Well, that's one of the main points here, that nothing can stop God's plans. And Esther couldn't stop God's plans, but he could use her. And she consents to be used. Now, of course, we know God is sovereign over that as well. Now, turning to chapters 5 and 6, we find another sub-principle that will come out of this story. But let's continue on here with the story. Now, remember, Esther had consented here to go through with it and to see the king, and there was some fasting going on and kind of leading up to it. And then she finally comes to the king, and he holds out the scepter to her, and she's not killed for entering his presence uncalled. And then the king asks, "What's your request, Esther?" And she requests that the king and Haman come to a dinner that she's going to prepare just for the two of them. And then in verse 5, we pick up the story, and it says, "Then the king said, 'Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires.' So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. And as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, 'What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done.'" Here's Esther's moment. She can nail Haman right here. But what does she say? "So Esther answered and said, 'My petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my petition and do what I request,'" she can get him. She can get him right here. But what does she say? "May the king and Haman come to the banquet which I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says." You know? Couldn't quite get it together there to nail Haman. Well, what is the consequence of that? Haman and the king leave the banquet, and as Haman's leaving the banquet that she threw for them, he sees Mordecai and is reminded of his hatred for Mordecai. And he goes home and he complains about it, and his wife says, well, hey, why don't you just get rid of the guy? Have a gallows built. Have him hanged and be done with him. Haman goes, oh, that's a good idea. So Haman is ready to destroy Mordecai. I mean, Mordecai could have got killed here because Esther hesitated. Because Esther didn't get him right when she had him right there in front of the king. So the plot's getting a little thicker here. And then we pick up the story in chapter 6, and it says, here's God. This is just like him. During that night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? Remember, we told you God would use this. Then the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which had been prepared for him. Talk about timing. Here we go. And the king's servants said to him, behold, Haman is standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? Here's the height of conceit. And Haman said to himself, whom would the king desire to honor more than me? Then Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let him bring a royal robe which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed. And let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Then the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said. What a reversal, huh? So Haman takes the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback to the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. And Haman recounted to Zeresh, he's always running home to his wife and belly aching. Haman recounted to Zeresh's wife and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and Zeresh's wife said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. It's encouragement you can always hope to receive at home there. The principle here, I think, is that God even intervenes upon our weaknesses to secure and enhance his purposes. You know, many times there have been times when I felt personally like my efforts at ministry, trying to live the Christian life, were like walking on a treadmill, that they were getting nowhere and they were accomplishing nothing. And certainly I can look back on the time that I've known the Lord and have desired to serve him and see times where I've fallen short and haven't been as faithful to God's people and ministering to their needs as I ought to have been. And then you'll find it, you know, then I'll find out later that somebody has been blessed anyway. I got a couple friends, and I won't mention their names because they could become embarrassed, whom, you know, I could have been a better friend to. I could have served more. But maybe God used me in some small way in their life and then multiplied it tremendously. I come back and I'll hear of a testimony about how God used me in their life to teach them some doctrine or to give them some perspective. And they went out and spread it to all these different people, and all kinds of lives are being changed. Now, I could have done more. There were times I hesitated. I could have been a better friend. I could have been more faithful in service to my God. But he took what meager and imperfect efforts that were there and multiplied them in spite of myself. Now, that's pretty awesome. And the same thing happens here. Esther hesitates. Her service, she's going in the right direction, but her service is less than perfect at this point. And yet God uses that very situation to turn it around and to enhance his plans and puts Mordecai in a little bit more special position. In fact, God had even prepared ahead of time by having Mordecai uncover that plot. And somehow all of this is going to be working together to make the final outcome of the story all the greater. And of course, you know, our goal, like we were saying before, shouldn't be to get away with as little as possible, counting on God to cover our tracks. Because there's no life in that. Mediocrity is dead bones. It's dry dust. So we should continue to strive to be the best that God can enable us to be, realizing, of course, that it's totally dependent upon him to bring all that to fruition. But realize that when we failed, when we look back and we're not all that we should be, that's not going to mess up God's plans. That God is still going to use what little usefulness we have presented, and he's going to multiply it. We've got to keep that in perspective, or we could totally despair. So nothing is going to stop God's plans is one sub-principle, and God even intervenes upon our weaknesses to secure and enhance his purposes. But we see the story continuing to unfold, and we find a kind of a climactic section to this story, which I think presents the so what and the final climax of our own pilgrimage. Let's go on here with chapter 7. Now, Haman is sitting there stewing, and around that time, it's come time for the second dinner, the second meal which Esther has planned. So Esther's grabbed by the king's eunuchs and hastily brought to the banquet for Esther. And picking it up in verse 1, it says, "Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen." This is dinner number 2. "And the king said to Esther on the second day also, as they drank their wine at the banquet, 'What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done.' Then Queen Esther," finally gets it together here, "answered and said, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with annoyance to the king.' Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, 'Who is he, and where is he? Who would presume to do thus?' And Esther said, 'A foe and an enemy is the wicked Haman.' Then Haman became terrified before the king and the queen." Trapped. And then it talks about the king's kind of disillusioned at this for a moment, and he gets up and he storms outside. And in the meantime, Haman starts to plead for his life before Queen Esther. And you've seen this in movies and stuff, how this stuff kind of works out. And in the process, he just sort of slips and he's falling all over her right when the king decides to come back into the room. And so you know how the king interpreted that one. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. Then the king said, 'Will they even assault the queen with me in the house?' As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face." He's sitting putting a sack over this guy's head. He's going to get it. "Then Harbonah, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Ultimately, the harm that is intended for God's people is going to be reversed upon their enemies. Every evil which has been plotted and planned against the Lord's people, Jews in the past, Christians now, by the world, is going to be turned on their own head in judgment. And we find this principle repeated even in 1 Peter chapter 2, which I won't turn to. It says something to the effect that keep your behavior excellent before the Gentiles, the very thing for which they slander you, because it's going to be to your glory, more or less it's going to be to your glory at the day of revelation, or when Christ returns. You know, I'm thinking of a situation. There was someone in our Bible study the other night shared a difficult circumstance at work. He is in the banking business, and his superior wanted him to go through with a loan that was less than kosher, let's say. There was some dishonesty involved. And the pressure was on him to do this, or, you know, who knows, maybe he would lose the job or something. And, you know, one way to look at that whole thing is, good night, you know. Here I am trying to do what the Lord wants me to do, and I could end up losing my job. And look at that as a totally negative situation. But actually, what is going on there, that conflict, is proving that our brother is headed for glory. It's proving that he's different from the rest of the world. And it's a sign of glory for him, as 2 Thessalonians 1 would tell us, and a sign of destruction for the person who's putting the pressure on him. And someday there's going to be a day when all those who've been persecuted for the sake of Christ will arrive and be totally glorified for eternity. And those who have been against them, in being against them, have proven the glory which was at work and developing in the Christians and proving their own degenerate nature in the process and setting themselves up for judgment. And it's going to be reversed on their heads. And I think that the thing that we can take from this is that even when we encounter hassles which are outside of us, when we're persecuted, to keep in perspective that's not necessarily a bad thing when you see it from the hilltop of God's sovereignty. But actually it's proof of who we are and what we are, and that we are headed for glory. It's authentication, if you will. And we should receive it with praise and thanks. Only Christians would have that kind of weird approach to daily struggles. But then only Christians can see things from that vantage point. Well, from here, the story basically concludes. It comes to a resolve. The climax here, of course, was Haman getting hanged on his own gallows. And the very attacks that the world perpetrates on us are going to be used for our glory and against them at the return of Jesus Christ. But as we continue on, we kind of see the aftermath of all this. It says in chapter 8, verse 1, that on that day, the day, I guess, that Haman was hanged, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken away from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. And then it goes on, and it says, tells how the Jews come before Xerxes, Mordecai and Esther come before Xerxes or Ahasuerus, and they say, hey, you know, there's this problem that still isn't solved yet. There's still that day set for the annihilation of the Jews. What are we going to do about it? The king says, well, I can't reverse my decree, but I'll tell you what, I'll issue another edict or another decree which will give the Jews permission to defend themselves. And so the decree went out, And the Jews were gearing up to destroy their enemies and all that hated them. And before it goes on to sort of live that out, it sort of already comes to the conclusion right at the end of chapter 8. It says in verse 15, right after this arrangement has been made, "Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple. And the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor. And in each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them."
Unfortunately, at this point in the original tape, the remainder of the message was not recoverable. Therefore, this is the end of the message. God bless you, and we hope you found this tape useful in your study of God's Word.